Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in to the NOLA Drink Show, friends. Hey, I do appreciate it. As always, got a fun show coming up for you here today. As I mentioned last week, our resident beer experts, Sal and Matt, return. And we're doing something a little different this time around. We are talking about sort of a year in review kind of thing as it relates to beer. Most of the numbers for 2019 are not out yet, so there are a few, and we pull some of that in, but we took some of the prognostications from 2018, saying what people thought were going to happen in 2019, and then I put it to those guys to ask them, well, did it happen or not? So we look at some styles of beer that were supposedly going to trend. We talked about some of the business numbers about growth of craft beer versus just growth of beer or lack of growth, I should say, of beer overall, and just some things like that. So a lot of fun there. We sample some beers here and there as well, as we usually do. But it's a lot of conversation just sort of about the market for beer, as I said, emerging styles. We talk about some styles that have kind of come onto the scene and we define what they are. So some interesting stuff there. And if you're listening on the radio, as always, I encourage you to get the podcast. We call that Another Shot with Noel Drinks. And you can get that on your favorite podcast network, the whole show. But that would include Another Shot with Noel Drinks. Or you can get it on our website, noladrinks.com. What we do in that segment, tie up some loose ends, talk a little bit more about a couple trends, but then I asked those guys to give me some predictions of what we think we might see in 2020. Nothing too crazy, but just some things we might want to be paying attention for, and some of the continued growth of particular styles and some things like that. So some pretty interesting conversation there. Friends, a really quick programming note. We're going to have one, maybe two more shows before we take off for one, maybe two shows for the holidays. We'll let you know a little bit about that. Go check us out on social media at NOLA Drinks on Instagram and Facebook, and at NOLA Drinks 1, the number 1 on Twitter. We'll keep you posted with what we do. Already started to line up some really cool stuff for 2020 coming right out of the gate, and we'll be letting you know about that soon, friends. Hey, we're going to bounce right over to Old Rail Brewing Company in Old Mandeville, as we usually do for our beer chats with Matt and Sal, right after this break. Going to take a little break here, friends, on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back.
Get in the groove and let the good times roll. We're going to stay here to soothe our soul. It takes all that long.
Down yonder, down on the farm. Down yonder, where I was born.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be, friends. As you know, we are here at Old Rail Brewing Company in Mandeville, chatting with Sal Mortellaro and Matt Horney, and everyone has done a shoe check.
Sal, yes.
You've done your shoe check.
There is no gum on the bottom of my shoes.
It's our inside joke there that comes from an episode some time ago, and we will move forward from that. But guys, thank you very much for joining the show, as we regularly do, talking about brews here. And both of you, welcome to the show again.
Thanks. Yes. Thank you.
Always
good to be back.
To be here.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, you guys. And I'm going to skip a lot of the formalities, other than Matt, you're the brewmaster here at Old Rail mm-hmm. Brewing Company, a certified beer judge. Mm-hmm. Sal, you are a grandmaster beer judge and certified in many other things.
Yes.
Yes, including recently newly minted bartender.
That's right. I got to have my first go at actually professionally bartending last night, which was fun.
Strong word.
Always enjoyed doing cocktails at the house, throwing it together, and putting it to actual use for once. So I kind of feel like a home brewer that went to the professional side now. I guess that's kind of the way it works, right?
There you go. And do you have your certification card that you can show me at this point?
I have the ATC card I can show you.
Yeah, okay, that's good enough. You got your SaveServe card. Okay, right on. Awesome. That's very cool. And go check out our friends here at Grateful Ape. We'll talk about that sometime down the road. But we're talking about beers, you guys, and we are here at the end of 2019. And we don't have all the numbers and things, obviously, market data from this year. We won't see that until a few months into 2020. But we do have some things that we've learned during 2019. We also have some things that we learned during 2018 that I think a lot of these trends have prevailed in the past year. So we're going to talk about that coming up here. And then we're also, when we do the podcast only portion of the show, we're going to take a look forward to 2020. At least that's the plan as we have it now. So let me ask you guys some of these questions. We're talking about some of the things that we were seeing in 2018 and some of the things we were seeing in 2019. At the Great American Beer Festival, which I know you're a participant in and you judge, we had six new categories pop up this year.
Correct.
Fresh hop beer, India pale lager, Franconian style, rot beer, juicier hazy strong pale ale, emerging India pale ale, and contemporary Belgian style Goza lambic. Now, I'm going to ask you what, can you guys quickly tell me what all six of those are? Some of them I know what they are, and three of them I have no idea what the hell they are. How about those? So the first one, fresh hop beer, just made with fresh hops, not dry hops, right?
Yeah, usually done during hop harvest season.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Whole cone hops just added into the boil or into the mash or however you see fit.
And we're seeing more of that because there's more fresh hops available, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The general idea? It's been a thing that's gone on for a while. I know when I was at Terrapin, we did it every year. And it's kind of gaining popularity a little bit now. Especially with some of the newer hops that we have.
Okay, so newer hops, more hops available, and then just a new style. It's a little fickle to work with, too, isn't it?
I don't really do it here because I haven't really figured out a way to do it that makes me happy. And it's kind of you don't want to clog up your equipment with whole cone hops. So some people have a hop back. Some people have like an extra, vessel that they'll put the hops in. You can transfer it back to the mash tun, throw them in there, and screen it out somehow. There's other options to do. I just haven't gotten into it, but it makes things a little bit more complicated.
Okay.
Not by much, but a little bit more.
Okay, got it. But okay, a growing trend there. Mm-hmm. Now, India Pale Lager, I'm assuming, I think I know what that is, so we're talking about a hop-driven lager as opposed to a hop-driven ale. Is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We did this. We did a collaboration with Courtyard Brewing Company in New Orleans. We did a hoppy lager, essentially IPL. And it's cool to do. It's, lager yeast is pretty transparent stuff. It doesn't really carry a whole lot of complexity. So you get a lot of hop character that comes out of it, which is kind of cool.
So interesting. So the hop's going to pop more and then you get a little less sort of the fruity kind of note and some of that kind of stuff is what you don't get.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now this one, I don't know what it is. What is a Franconian style rot beer?
I don't.
So it's actually a German lager. The rot beer means red beer. It's a very deeply malty lager beer that more focuses on. It's more like a if you can imagine an amber ale or an Irish red ale.
Okay.
I guess the easiest way to describe it is like if you have an Irish red ale, it's more like a German red lager.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
It does. Yeah.
Kind of that same flavor character, but a lot cleaner.
So
more on the residual malt.
At the Great American Beer Fest, then, what beers would we see entered into that? We wouldn't see an Irish red ale. Is that its own category?
That's its own thing, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just making a comparison.
Gotcha, to give it.
Yeah, correct.
So we're seeing a growth then in that category. Who's making that kind of stuff?
You know, I really honestly don't know.
Okay.
I've never had one, but it actually sounds like a pretty good style.
Yeah, we might have to do that.
Okay. Yeah, I love lagers, so yeah, I mean, I can kind of get behind that.
Okay, right on. Cool.
It's a good, you think lagers, German lagers, you think, your box and I think that'd be a good, fun change of pace.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll look into that one for next show and get a little more detail on that. Of course, then one of the other ones, which I was almost kind of interested that it hadn't been added before, was the sort of juicy or hazy strong ale. But, I mean, I guess so the strong pale ale. Mm-hmm. So is that just basically a juicy IPA, but then it's a higher ABV? Is that what we're talking about, or what is that?
This is kind of interesting because if you're doing a strong pale ale, I mean, the difference between IPA and pale ale is one's hoppier.
Right.
And to me, when you get a pale ale, it's usually way, way less hops. And in a hazy style, And then the IPA is going to have a whole lot more hops, but they're not bitter, so there's no delineation between the two on that. So I don't. You'd have to have, it seems like, a lot more hops to balance out the alcohol.
Yeah, unless they're going for a little bit of higher of everything as a whole. Yeah.
Interesting. Yep. So maybe what we're doing is, what, because the categories then in question here have gotten so big that they're kind of splitting the parameters even further to shrink the categories or entries into said categories.
Well, so
instead of having a million in one, it's now having 50 million in one, and or 500,000 in one, and 500,000 in another, overstating, of course.
Well, and correct, and that's exactly what they're doing. And in fact, one of the new categories that they also brought this year, the emerging India Pale Ales.
Thank you, that was the next one.
And what that covers is these new spins on even hazy IPAs. I mean, your juicy IPAs, your New England IPAs, those are still a relatively new category, new style. But even then, you know, people are starting to do things like add lactose to them and things like that, where they really don't even fit as a quote-unquote traditional New England IPA. So that's where that emerging India Pale Ale comes in.
That sounds a little, like, in the future, it's going to become a little bit more complicated, because when does it become non-emerging anymore?
Sure. Yeah,
well, what do we mean by that exactly? You said adding lactose, but, like, what do we mean by like a growing category, or is there we're talking about a specific part of the process here.
People doing different things.
It's like new and upcoming kind of thing is what I imagine.
So it's like a catch-all kind of category gotcha.
Typically,
in
judging those categories would be specialty.
Sure.
So I don't know why they just didn't default to like a specialty hazy IPA category.
Got it. Okay. So renaming it that way. Yeah. That makes sense. And then we talk about a contemporary Belgian style goes alambic. So that's basically just people that are making it not in Belgium.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
Probably. Yep.
Got it. Okay, that makes sense. So, I find it very interesting because we look at the number of categories at Great American Beer Fest seems to be kind of growing. I also found that it was interesting that non-alcohol beer was added back for the first time since 2006.
That's correct.
And that's defined by any beer that's less than 0.5% alcohol. And the demand, it's actually the fifth fastest growing category behind such categories as sours, which we'll get into, I think, in American IPAs. But there is a growing trend. There's a growing demand for non-alcoholic beers. We're seeing a couple major label beer companies that are marketing non-alcoholic beers. And it seems also that this is probably the first time in 20, 25 years that there's been sort of a readdressing and innovation in the category. I recall that sort of push for non-alcoholic beers about 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And then they kind of disappeared, right? And then now we're seeing them again.
Right. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is that if you look, couple people that I know off the top of my head that are doing non-alcoholic beers, Heineken. Okay, yeah, sure. Yeah. They're a large worldwide macro fine. But you look at Brooklyn Brewing out of New York. They're doing a non-alcoholic beer. They're still a craft brewery that's arguably one of the larger craft breweries in the United States, but still, it's an actual craft brewery that's doing non-alcoholic beer. And even there is a brewery called Mikkeller. Mikkeller is out of Denmark, and they are known for doing a lot of weird, wacky, strange, extreme beers. So you have everybody pretty much from all the far corners of brewing, you know, your macro breweries, your American craft breweries, even your kind of wilder worldwide brewers such as Mikkeller, all doing non-alcoholic beer.
So not limited then, because I think back in the day when we were talking about it was only really the big houses that were doing non-alcoholic beer. So now we're seeing small or middle-sized guys, if anything, doing it as well.
Yep.
That's very interesting. Okay, cool. Well, so I just kind of want to roll through some of that as far as the Great American Beer Fest adding those categories and what we're seeing. But a couple other ones, too, that were on the horizon coming into this year. Session sours seem to kind of be predicted to be a growing category. Do we see that in 19, do you think?
I really haven't. I mean, I guess that would be probably some of the kettle soured stuff that's kind of gained, like the gozas and things like that. I'm imagining that's what that refers to.
I think so, because they're talking about, and I was going to ask you to say what it is, what they are, but my understanding is that, you're taking sour beers, which I think can be, sort of polarizing to some people, and then doing, lemon or lime cucumber, goza.
Berliner Weisses.
And these things, Berliner Weisses, precisely. Yeah. So we get that sour, but it's tempered by bringing in other flavors, and they tend to be a little bit lower in ABV, I think, also.
Yeah, I think you're going to continue to see that. I don't think that's really going to go anywhere. I think a lot of people kind of have latched onto that, and it's just kind of emerged or immersed into the whole culture of beer.
Yeah, and we did really see that, I think, in 19 as definitely being... I saw a lot more of that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, mm-hmm. Fair enough. Now, what about another one, too, that was sort of flagged to grow in 2019 was Brut IPAs. So, or so-called Brut IPAs, which I have not... That was what?
That was a flash in the pan.
Okay.
That came and went. You saw a few people doing it for a while. Homebrewers were doing it for a while.
Just using champagne yeast in making IPAs, correct?
Well, either using champagne yeast or still using traditional beer yeast, Saccharomyces, Cerevisiae, and then using various enzymes to help aid in... further that dryness,
okay.
And then upping the volume of carbonation in that beer to resemble a dry brut champagne as much as possible.
Gotcha. So a flash in the pan.
Yeah. I mean, you saw them for a little bit, but I can't recall seeing any on any breweries or even store shelves.
Okay.
You would hear about them, but you would never actually see them.
Right.
That's interesting because I was going through and kind of, as you guys know, we were talking about before we went on the air, I was pulling some of these things together to talk about and looking at some of the predicted trends coming into 19. And a lot of these, like the session sours, okay, I know what they are and I've seen them and can kind of give an opinion on it, whatever. And I was reading Brut IPA and I'm like, what the hell is that? Yeah. Never heard about it, never saw it. So, okay, good.
Yeah, I think the one that was the most widely available one was Stone. I think they made a Brut IPA.
Okay.
You would see that in those stores, but that's pretty much it.
Okay. So. Now, one of the ones to you guys, and we're going to take a break here in about a minute and a half, 2 minutes, but we talked about non-alcoholic beers, and we'll kind of, I don't necessarily think we need to talk about this too much. There's certainly been a little bit more of a push towards lower alcohol beers, and we've had, you know, the Michelob Ultras of the world and things like that going on for a while, and I don't think we need to touch on that. But I found it very interesting, too, because some people were talking about, you know, especially in 2018, that also there's been a little bit of a growth in the higher alcohol level beers. And so in 18, for example, that between 7 and 7.5% alcohol, that was 21.3% of the market share of craft beer. And then below 7 was 60.9%, which you would expect. And above 7.5% alcohol was 36.7. But harkening back to what I just said, that's a very fine range, right? 7% to 7.5% was, you know, just over 21% of the market share. So people were tending, or it was, you know, in 18, they were trending towards also looking for slightly higher alcohol beers.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm not exactly sure how that...
It seems kind of specific, right? Because then it's also like how you make your beer. That's a very narrow range of alcohol, but...
Yeah, the only thing you know, 7.5%... 7 to 7.5. I mean, we're not looking at any trends in barrel aging or anything like that, because that would be higher. I don't know why.
But maybe we just even kind of consider it over 7, because if you put those numbers together, then you're looking at, back a napkin, what is that, 35 and 20, so 55, 56%, 57%. So, I mean, that's a significant share is stuff. And, I mean, I think that speaks to craft beer in general. But maybe the idea then is people are not shying away from higher alcohol beers in the craft segment by and large, at least in 18. Do you think that was maybe fair to say this year, too?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. You have these breweries doing these beer releases, and that's what they're standing in line for. More than likely, it's these higher alcohol stouts, barrel-aged stouts and the such.
What Sal is saying is exactly right. But I'm kind of like thinking every time I would see a New England IPA, a fruited New England IPA, those usually trend to 7 and 7.5% range, just because the added fruit sometimes fermentation.
There we go. Okay.
And so those were really popular this year, and maybe that's where you're starting to see some of the spike in some of those numbers.
That would make sense, because that's been a significant growth category, a huge growth category is New England IPAs. Okay, cool. Let's do this, you guys. Let's take a little break here on the show. We're going to come back. We'll probably talk a little bit more about some trends in 19 as it relates to specific styles, but we're also going to talk about overall trends in beer that we saw predicted from 2018 into 19, and then we do the podcast. The only thing we're going to talk about, 2020. Friends, going to take a little break here on the Dollar Drink Show. Come on back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in. Yep, we are here at Old Rail Brewing Company in December. Holiday party rolling upstairs. oh, yeah, we got somebody playing some Grand Funk Railroad. I'm your captain. And we're actually drinking some beers here that Matt has lovingly created for us and brought to us. And we're conducting an interesting scientific experiment because something has been keeping Matt awake at night, and we're trying to figure out which beer it is. So we're going to roll through all of these, Matt, until we help you determine what beer it is that is keeping you awake at night.
Well, we do,
or
have,
may not even be beer, but we're going to find out. We're going down swinging one way or the other.
Well, we do have, 10 or 11 beers on tap, so we have our work cut out.
We do have, and we're not doing divide and conquer either, because we're not you.
Yeah, right.
So you actually have to go through all of these, and Sal and I will just either reinforce the data or dispute the data, I suppose, buddy, right?
Correct, yeah. Yeah, yeah. We're the controls.
We are the controls.
We
and
are the controls.
And we are here for Matt.
We are here for
Thank
Matt.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate that.
You know, I got a question for you, Brian.
Okay.
Since we were not called the unpaid beer correspondents.
There's no money for
that. Oh, man. I was hoping
nice
we were
try.
Getting... Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Like I told you, Matt, Sal, and both of you, that you know, I was kind of rolling through the credentials really quickly, and I shortened your titles and your experiences and stuff. And now, for legal purposes, I will never omit that again. But nice try, buddy.
It was worth a shot.
Yeah, hey, I'll
still show up.
Hey, thank you, man. I'll buy you a beer here at Old Rail.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, you guys, one of the things that we're talking about here is we're talking about, you know, sort of trends predicted coming into 2019. What we saw, what we didn't see, and we talked a lot about that in the first segment here. But there are three that I wanted to touch on really quickly. We did mention this a little bit when we were talking about higher ABV beers still kind of remaining popular and holding fast this past year, presumably. And we've talked about, quite a bit about this on the show before, juicier, so-called hazy-style IPAs. The most entries, Sal, at the Great American Beer Fest 2 years in a row was in that category, so 348 this year.
Correct.
And actually followed closely by American-style IPA with 342. I found that really interesting that, you know, that's huge growth, and it's held 2 years in a row. And just to kind of put a finer point on it, that the average per category overall, so again, 348 for hazy, 342 for American-style IPA, the average per category was 88.
Sure.
So it's massive.
It is. And even something that we touched on a little bit earlier on the last segment, or that we touched on earlier during the recording of the show, the last segment, was that we went through these six new categories, and four out of six are hop-centric beers. So trends, hops are here to stay, mm-hmm. And it just goes to show that how popular hops are, how even finite these hop beers can be.
Yeah, great point. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you for saying that, because four out of six, that's something interesting, and hops are going nowhere.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So what about, I think we've seen this too, that a growth in U.S.-made, and we're talking, and just for friends listening outside the country on the podcast, all of these numbers that I'm giving you are U.S.-based. So I think some of these trends will play in other places, but just to clarify that. But we are seeing people within the U.S. starting to address the Mexican-style lager. And I found this interesting too, because imports actually were still growing overall. Imports of beer into the United States were up 3.8% in 18. I would assume that number, just speculating here, but probably going to be similar in 19. I'm sure it wouldn't have gone down. I would be surprised. And a lot of that was led by imports of Mexican beers. So we are seeing U.S. brewers take that Mexican-style lager, which I think actually, as we've talked about on the show before, is really kind of synonymous with larger Latin American-style lagers, really, and making them here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I've seen people doing... calling them Mexican-style lagers. And Sal, maybe you can talk to this a little bit more, but I've seen people just putting it on the menu and adding lime to it.
Which is not what you traditionally do with Mexican Central American and South American beers anyway.
It's
to clean the rim of the glass with reused bottles. But anyway, go on. Yeah.
And I was always kind of dumbfounded if I wouldn't see that. But, you know, we talked about this, I think, before, about the history of Mexican beer and mm-hmm. its tie back to Germany. And... they just make, I think we may have talked about, me and Sal always enjoyed Negra Modelo
yep.
as one of the finer Vienna-style lagers.
Me too, yep.
And, you know, I don't know exactly what constitutes Mexican-style lager, per se.
And that's sort of why I was saying this. I think we're talking about that German tradition where German brewers were brought over to really the entirety of Latin America, but a lot of Central America and a lot of South America, Northern South America, mm-hmm. to open breweries for people.
Right.
And so we see that style basically being brought with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think the stuff that's made in Mexico is basically, it's very similar to the stuff that you find made in Guatemala and made in Costa Rica or whatever mm-hmm. we're talking about.
It is. Those Central and South American, Mexico is in North America, but, you know, Spanish-speaking country lagers, they all do have that same quality. I've traveled around Costa Rica, Guatemala, Honduras, obviously, Belkin beer out of Belize, and, you know, they all have that same flavor. But it's interesting to see, to come back to the U.S., it's interesting to see because I can think of, just off the top of my head, real fast, four breweries in the New Orleans area that have a quote Mexican style lager that they put out. So it's interesting to see that even here locally, and then it just kind of speaks to lagers as a whole and those coming around.
Let me ask you guys this then, kind of maybe to contrast it a little bit. We're taking that style of beer, it's a little bit of a heavier style lager than the American light lager,
sure.
Right?
Yeah, correct.
So, I mean, maybe that's how people can differentiate is what we're talking about is we're not talking about Coors or Budweiser.
Oh, yeah.
That we're talking about something that's got a little more weight, a little more mouthfeel, right? Mm-hmm.
A little more flavor as a whole.
A little more flavor as a whole.
Sometimes they have a little bit of a corny flavor depending on who's making it, but yeah, that's exactly right. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be more of a much more flavorful style lager than American lagers, and I really think that speaks to a lot of craft beer drinkers who say, hey, I want something a little bit more than, you know, Budweiser.
So if we put that up against a German lager, I mean, what are we looking at then as opposed to the Mexican lager?
Okay.
I'd say 1, 2, and 3, right?
Yeah.
With the American, Mexican, and then German lagers.
As far as weight and
flavor
mouthfeel
and right.
flavor intensity.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. With the German being on top. And this would make sense, right? If you're going to a warmer environment like you would in Latin America, that you might be dial that back a little bit when you're making, you know, starting to make these beers 150 years ago, 200 years ago in some cases, I think. But
I agree with that 100%. Yeah, correct.
Cool. All right. Well, and then we've talked about lagers a lot, but lagers continue to be, it's interesting because I think lagers overall with the big producers have been steadily declining, American style lagers, light lagers, about 1% annually. But whereas we've seen the so-called craft treatment, there's 18 styles at the Great American Beer Fest this past year. 1,764 entries were lagers across those 18 styles. That's 18.6% of the total, and that's up from 1,345 or 15.8% from 2017. Do we see that this year, Sal, too, where lagers are at GABF, where we're still seeing people entering those beers? And, I mean, Matt, you've been doing one here, so, mm-hmm. I mean, we're seeing that, right?
I think this year, I say craft lager is increasing. I think next year it's going to continue to increase. I just think it's going to grow and grow. I think more people are going to get curious about it and they're going to want to brew it.
Okay.
More customers are going to ask for it because they're going to hear it more in the, you know, kind of the beer world and beer stories and things like that. So I think this year was a big year for craft lager.
Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. And to your point, Sal, too, where it's speaking to the craft trend, where people want to see, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but people wanting to see lagers and be brought into that fold and giving you options, more taste and more whatever variety and care and production.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's not fair to say care and production, but I think.
Well, you know, kind of one of my go-to beers right now is, and I really like this beer, Abita just put out a beer called Hop 99. And what Hop 99 is it is a direct poke at Michelob Ultra.
Okay.
It's a 99-calorie beer with 2.6 grams of carb in it. And, of course, if you've had Michelob Ultra, you know it doesn't taste like much.
And it's 89 calories,
right.
I think, right?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah. I think it's actually only, it's something
it's
like that, but it's close
something
enough.
Like that, okay, yeah.
But they took this Hop 99 and added a whole bunch of hops to it. So it's almost like a ultralight IPL.
Like a Michelob Light with, okay.
It's almost like an ultralight IPL.
Like an India Pale
India
Lager.
India Pale Lager.
Okay.
To where it's just all this hop flavor. And it's great. It's great for me personally because I don't eat carbs, so I can drink them. I try to save, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I
try to save it sometimes. And if I just want a beer and not think about it. I've been known to go to that beer lately. But yeah, that kind of speaks to what we're talking about in regards to light lagers, adding more flavor to light lagers, kind of crafting up these light lagers and going from there.
Okay, cool. Well, you guys, let's do this. Let's take a little break on the show. We're going to come back, talk a little bit about the larger beer category as we kind of see it from 2019. And then in the podcast only portion, we're going to talk about, probably finish some of that up, and then we're going to talk about 2020. Come on back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. No, we do not take live callers at this particular point in time. Sorry, inside joke. We're talking a little bit about beer trends from predicted in 2018 as we moved into 2019, as you know. And stick around for the podcast-only portion, friends. If you're listening on the radio, go to NolaDrinks.com. Get that, because we're going to probably tie up some loose ends, and we're going to get into some bold predictions for 2020. But you guys, we touched on some categories and some different types of beer and some things that did we see this in 2019 or not, and we moved pretty quickly, but I think it was really interesting. I think overall it's important to talk about how in 2018 that, you know, generally in the past couple of years that alcohol sales in the United States have been pretty flat. In 2018, beer was down 1.3%. As a matter of fact, we were talking about domestic light lagers, American light lagers, they were down 3.8%. But it's still a significant share of the market, of course, and it's been trending down about 1% a year lately. But that being said, that when we talk about craft beers, that we're not in double-digit growth anymore. We haven't had double-digit growth in craft beers since 2014. It was up 13% from the previous year, and actually that was the last time it topped double digits. And as a matter of fact, going from 2014 at 13%, in 15 it was to 8.5%, and just in 2018 I believe it was only 4%. And everybody goes, oh, that sounds kind of scary, but if we actually look at the numbers, craft beer has doubled from 2010 to 2018, and we see that in case sales, we see that in market share overall. So it's not all doom and gloom, is it? But I think what we see here, let me just say this really quickly, what we see here is that we've seen beer kind of drop. We've seen alcohol sales flatten out, but the two growth areas that we've actually seen in the beer category anyway are craft and what's also lumped in the so-called malt beverage category, which is your White Claw stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So what are your thoughts, Matt, on what we saw this past year? And
I think we definitely saw the White Claw movement as a big deal.
It's bigger than it was the year before. I have
experience with this. When I was in Destin this summer on vacation, going into the local Publix and finding that there was no White Claw available when it was requested by a specific person that was staying in my house, my girlfriend.
And were people, were she or other people rioting?
Well, you know, there was confusion as to why this was not available. I do think that the hard seltzer thing is very evident this year. It made its place, and
let me just say this, Matt, because mm-hmm. then it was in 2018 it was up 5.1%, and it was a 4.3% market share of beer. Mm-hmm. 2019 it's going to have blown doors on that.
Yeah.
When we see the 2019 numbers.
Yeah. I think it'll be crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But
what do we think about craft, you guys? We only have a few minutes left before we close out the radio portion of the show, because are we? And we'll talk about this in the podcast only thing, because I think there's some underpinnings here. Where do we see craft as being now more of like, it's a mature market, right? You can't expect double digit growth year over year over year. And when we consider that beer overall has dropped a little bit and alcohol sales are flat, we are still seeing growth in craft.
Correct. Mm-hmm. You know, we're seeing the same people over the last couple of years, those same people that helped double those digits are still drinking beer. And if we see growth, even if they stop drinking craft beer, we still have people replacing them higher than we're losing them. That leads to a whole nother conversation, though. There's a big debate within the craft beer industry of whether there's market saturation.
We're at 8,000, almost 8,000 breweries, I think.
But if we still see growth, you know, there still is growth. Now, maybe it's not that sweet gold that we remember only a few years ago, but there's still growth.
Mm-hmm. And I think it was fresh and it was new, and it was a lot of mom and pop people creating this new business that they were leaving other careers for. And I think Parrish is an example. Andrew Godley left engineering to start his company. There was a lot of that happening. And those people have kind of, it started to get slower and slower and slower. But as we've transitioned from the early 2000s when this boom was starting to happen, late 1990s, we've transitioned to a new generation of drinker at this point. So we're moving into a new territory with a new thought process, and I think you're going to see that kind of playing into what we start seeing.
That's a good way to put that, Matt, because then if you think about it, that we've, through this boom period, we've then, as you said, seen a change of generation of drinker. Mm-hmm. But yet still growth is there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's a positive sign. That's a really good point that you make. And, you know, are we also agreeing with the idea that people, I mean, we know that people are drinking less overall, and younger people are drinking less overall. As a matter of fact, 25% of younger drinkers are drinking 25% less than the same age group did 25 years ago, if you follow that. Are we drinking less but drinking better?
Yeah.
You think so? Do you agree with that, Sal?
I can buy that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So people are looking
more selective.
More selective, mm-hmm. higher quality. Mm-hmm. What about this idea too, the new, like searching for the new versus searching for the core consistency?
I think there's going to be more core consistency. I mean, we can get more into that in the
Because I think they'll talk about tap rooms versus what that facilitates, but
I do think that's going to be kind of a focus. As far as like
mid-sized small brewers,
And I think you're going to see that drop off and like waiting in line for bottles and stuff like that, like you've seen in the past. I don't think that's what the new generation of drinker. I don't think they're going to want to do that. I think you can see that in their preference. You know, craft cocktails, hard seltzers, and things like that. So I think there's going to be a change in the way that craft beer operates, as it merges in with these new up and coming things and finds its place among other things as new drinkers come into the cycle.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Any quick last thoughts there, Sal?
No, that's me and Matt are on the same page.
Okay, cool. Well, you guys, so what we're going to do is I mentioned that we're going to move into the podcast-only segment. If you're listening on the radio, go to noladrinks.com. We're going to kind of put a few finer points, I think, on some of the underpinnings of what we saw 2018-2019 that sort of shed some light on the growth versus non-growth within the larger category and within the craft category as well. And then we're also going to – I've asked these two guys to think of a bold prediction or two for 2020. Not a weak prediction, but a bold prediction. But in the last minute and a half or so that we have left, Matt, tell people where we can find you at Old Rail Brewing Company here in Old Mandeville, buddy.
Yep, we're at the St. Tammany Trace Trailhead. To Causeway North. I've said this so many times now, I should know this, but get off the Causeway, head to the east.
Just tell us the address. People have Google Maps.
Yeah, six that's probably the easiest way. 639 Gerard Street, Mandeville.
Website, Facebook.
Yep. www.oldrailbrewery.com, oldrailbrewing.com.
Google Old Rail Brewing. That's cool.
Facebook. That's probably the best thing you can do. It's all there.
The link will be in the notes.
Yeah. So, Facebook, that's where you can find us. Maps, all that kind of stuff's there. Phone numbers there, all that kind of
awesome.
Stuff.
Awesome. And Sal, I think you'll agree that Matt is one of the finest beer makers around, huh?
I agree.
Well, thank you for being succinct on that level, Sal.
Thank you.
Very, very effusive, Sal. Sal, where do we find out about BJCP, the Beer Judging Certification Program, buddy?
BJCP.org. That's going to be a worldwide organization, been around since 1985, gold standard for beer judging, both on the homebrew and the commercial scale. BJCP.org, go there, get all the information on competitions, exams on how to be one, the whole bit. Facebook as well, checking them out.
Awesome. You guys, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And friends, again, check out the podcast because we're going to continue on. We're going to drink more beers, talk about these beers, talk about trends, talk about other stuff. But if you are listening on the radio, remember to be kind to one another, use your turn signal, and until next time, cheers, y'all.
said. All these saints and all these sinners will try to bend your ear. It don't matter who you're serving, we're all the same down here.
All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for sticking around for another Shot with Noel Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you as always. Yeah, great beer conversation as usual with Matt and Sal, doing something a little different this time, talking about sort of the year that was in beer. We're going to bounce right back over to Old Rail Brewing Company here in just a second and talk a little bit about what we think's coming up in 2020. Here we go.
All right, everybody, another Shot with Noel Drinks. Thanks for listening in. We are talking about beer, and I think we want to put a few closing points or finer points on what we were talking about, guys, here with 2019. And we kind of bolted through a few things in talking about the last year, about beer growth, craft beer growth still continuing, summarizing here, of course, a bit, alcohol being flat, overall beer sales being down a bit. But let's talk a little bit, you guys, about the underpinnings. I did mention the idea that 25% of younger drinkers were drinking 25% less than the same age group 25 years ago, for all three of those 25s. So I think we are seeing people drink less, but maybe better. People are drinking less on balance. There are some health considerations and things like this. But Matt, you were saying something before we went on the air, talking about a generational consideration, mm-hmm. which I think you raised a really good point yeah. that we all kind of want to do different than the previous generation.
Yeah, this is from an article that I was reading either, I think it was this morning or yesterday. And it kind of goes into the context of that your father's generation is something that you want to do different than. And when you kind of put this in perspective, if your father's generation is the 60s, 70s, Miller Lite, Budweiser, you know, Coors drinker, now we have the craft beer movement from the next generation. So now that this generation that started the craft beer movement is now growing up,
I think you're talking about sort of my generation growing up in, mm-hmm. you know, being a teenager, young adult in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. So that original craft right. beer movement uh-huh. of the Sierra Nevadas and right. the pyramids and things like that, mm-hmm. That's sort of what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you very much. Step on it. Thank you. Kind stuff coming from the kitchen here from the chef. I think we have some buffalo oysters here, don't we?
Yeah, that's what it looks like. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So we'll give a plug here out to chef in just a second. But so, yeah, I think, you know, we had that original craft movement. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of worth talking about this briefly yeah. because we had a blow up of sort of an earlier craft or small brewery movement in the late 80s and early mm-hmm. 90s. Mm-hmm. And that tanked
yeah.
early to mid 90s.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, we wanted to do so. That was my generation mm-hmm. or my original experience yeah. with smaller beers.
Yeah. So it kind of like it started a spark. The spark didn't really take so much as right. as much as everybody probably would have liked it to. But then in the 90s, like the home brewing, you know, the Zymergy magazine came out, the BYO kind of stuff started, the Homebrewers Association became more vocalized. So things started kind of changing in the 90s. And then as we move into the 2000s, it's like the homebrewers were kind of booming. The BJCP really kind of took off. And, you know, competitions start flourishing, you know.
More Thank food, you. Yeah, oh, more food. More pork food belly's coming in from the kitchen.
So you get these kind of like, I think they're kind of, you know, changes in I don't know, generations. Mm-hmm. Where this goes from here is going to be the interesting thing, because now as we have the millennial generation, which has proven to be drastically different than anything previous, what are they going to choose? Where is it going to go? And it seems to be going towards craft cocktails and hard seltzers and things like that. And then you see these numbers where, you know, consumption's declined, but what's it declining from? You know, is it the taste of alcohol? Is it just spirits in general, beer in general, or is it that is it money? You know, is it any of these things, or just selecting, being more selective, paying more money for something and drinking less of it?
Do you think, and Sal, feel free to chime in here too. I think you've touched on a lot of the key factors. I think it's probably multiple, right? In that we do talk about money expenditure, disposable income, people being perhaps cautious with that on some levels. I think we talk about, as we spoke about, drinking less but drinking better. We have arguably nearly 8,000 breweries now just in the United States alone. But what we're also seeing is we're seeing a greater diversification of what's available on the market. We have SKUs and SKUs and SKUs of beers available competing for shelf space. We also have a significant growth in the number of wineries in the country and globally. And we also have a significant growth in the spirits category. And I think that what we probably had back in, you know, decades ago, two, three, 4 decades ago, especially before the craft cocktail movement and the blow up of smaller wineries maybe 30 years ago, is people were drinking, I drink beer, I drink wine, I drink cocktails. People are drinking across categories more.
Yeah.
And we're also seeing more and more craft spirits being made, both in the United States, and more things that are being imported that disappeared, used to be available from Europe, or new stuff coming in from Europe and the old world. So simply that there's a much greater choice, and I think people are drinking across categories more.
Well, and you wonder, too, because...
And I'm going to eat with my fingers. Go on, Sal, sorry. Yeah.
You wonder, too, because as people's palates become more educated on what constitutes a good drink or a good cocktail, people know good beer, people know good wine, and I think that it kind of opens the door to exploration, to seeing what's out there. Maybe that may be part of what we're seeing with this. People are drinking more across the board as a whole.
That makes sense. Let's talk about this, you guys. Sorry, because we're eating some really delicious food. Give shout out to Chef here.
Oh, yeah.
Because he brought us some really good food.
So Chef Brett, he does a great job with the food here. And we occasionally will do beer dinners, and that's when he really gets to shine and kind of do the cool stuff. And he does some really great food during these beer dinners that we'll put on. But the stuff we have right now, he's got the pork belly appetizer out here, and he's got the buffalo oysters, both really great. I tend to lean more towards seafood stuff, so I go with buffalo oysters. But he does a great job. He's been here since the beginning, and he runs a good ship.
Nice. Now, do you work closely with him?
Yeah, we're good friends. We hang out together. And when we need to, we'll put, you know, stuff together and we'll talk about stuff, but, we're usually working independently of each other, but on occasion we do get together and
taste and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Well, so getting back to the beer thing. I think we talked about a lot of diversification. We talk about multiple SKUs. We talk about different choices, people drinking less, people drinking better, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. We've had more of a trend also towards local. Mm-hmm. I think, and drinking local has coming back a lot more. How does that affect things, Matt? And do you think that, you know, in regards to tap rooms and the role that tap rooms play? Mm-hmm. Because I think some people think that tap rooms are causing competition for retailers, and that gives them some pause that, like, I've got, you know, that kind of thing going on. And then I think other people, it drives innovation, and it's not really competition. It's brand building.
It's interesting. There's a lot of different avenues that this can go down. And as a brew pub brewer, a tap room does become direct competition with me. It becomes direct competition with, you know, a craft beer bar. You know, if we have one down the street. And, you know, for full disclosure, that's a sister bar of ours. But at the same time, you know, at first I was like, you know, well, they get the choice to distribute. They get the choice to do these things. We don't even get the choice, but they can compete directly with us. They can have televisions. They can have food. They can act as like a full-on restaurant almost. And, you know, that as a brewer in my setting, restricted, it gets a little frustrating. Would I restrict what they do? Absolutely not. You know, I would like to see these things, and I wouldn't take anything away from anybody. I just want to see more growth and more opportunity. But the tap rooms as a whole, if I was going to open something, I would definitely go tap room route and no distribution. I think a neighborhood little jaunt, a good neighborhood craft beer place to go to is super valuable. And I think more and more places, you know, larger cities, you know, look at Atlanta. I have a bunch of friends that are just opening up some stuff probably three of my friends opened up three breweries this fall. But they're all local. They're not going anywhere outside of that region, outside that city. It's all just for those people. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that. I think that's going to be more of a trend in cities. Maybe it'll start pushing out into smaller towns. You'll start seeing more craft breweries in small towns. And that as a whole, when you add all of those people up together, is going to be the major major competition for some of the larger breweries like the Budweisers and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I think the niche neighborhood little nook is the trend.
Okay. Mm. Saul, do you want to add to that? I haven't asked you specifically for, and we'll get to this, the, you know, so-called bold predictions for 2020, but do you want to add to what we're talking about here with the, pardon me, with the taproom consideration and the role that that plays versus breweries that sell in an on-premise and off-premise situation?
I do agree with Matt. If I was to do it, I would definitely open up a local taproom only kind of thing. The fact that you have more creativity, that you have a direct customer base, like a local customer base, you can maintain a great following as long as you put out a great product. You can establish a very great and a very consistent following of customers. That's really the way to go. There's a few places that are opening up right now around the Baton Rouge area that are going to be taproom local only. There's three or four that are opening up right now or in the midst of opening up that are going to be taproom only. And that's kind of one of the things I see with Louisiana, it seems. A lot of people are trying to get away from that distribution model.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And go with the on-premise mm-hmm. taproom.
Let me ask you, and we're kind of touching on this, but let me ask you to sort of react to this quote, because some people, I think, are, you know, they're sort of threatened by the taproom sort of model here. And the guy who runs Dogfish Head, Caglione,
is that his name? Caglione,
excuse me. He says, quote, "I worry that the category," referring to taprooms, "I worry that the category is trapped in the smiling jaws of death, where the taproom model is the bottom jaw and the top jaw is the top 50 breweries. Remember, well over half of the volume of these top breweries comes from producers outside of the craft trade associations. They're former craft breweries that have been bought out by global companies." What are your reactions to that, Matt? I mean, there's a truth mm-hmm. that, like, a lot of these guys are marketing themselves yeah. as crap, but they've been bought by AB InBev and things like that.
I think what he says has some merit to it, but I think when what the larger breweries have done is basically they still haven't really changed anything, because what they're going for is whatever's going to be on the store shelf in your grocery store. That's not necessarily a bike ride down the street to your local pub or your brew pub or, you know, tap room. And, you know, people aren't dumb. You know, they'll go to a city meeting when somebody's going to open something, and they'll go and learn about it. And, you know, they'll find out who's behind it. So if AB InBev is going to start opening up a small craft tap room in a town, you know, I don't know how the laws really factor in on that, because there are laws between distribution breweries and tap rooms.
Certainly in Louisiana, they mm-hmm. can't.
Right, but yeah. So I don't know if they would actually be able to pull that off. But what they're shooting for in that market, I don't think they can actually achieve, because it's something so unique and so specific to an individual owner and that community link that I don't think they can actually achieve that. Now, if you want to emulate a craft brewery and buy one and put the product in a Publix or a Kroger or whatever it is, that's a different story. And I think that market's going to evolve and it's going to change. And I don't think it's always going to be the same. But I do think, you know, the market for an independent brewer I think there's more value in that as a whole.
Okay.
You might not make a whole lot of money doing it, but it depends on what makes you happy.
Okay. And, yeah. and do you think his point, because, and I think we should be clear too, because Dogfish Head was acquired by Boston Beer, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is Sam Adams.
Yeah. And I like when they announced that they considered it a merger. It was very specific in their wording on that. That wasn't a buyout. It wasn't a takeover. It was a merger. So that was interesting.
Right. Mm-hmm. More or less a takeover by Boston Beer, correct?
Yeah, and it was kind of interesting, because when I was at the Craft Brewers Conference, Sam Caglione was talking with the brewmaster at Rodenbach, and they were actually collaborating. It was the first collaboration that Rodenbach had ever done. And, you know, it was a big talk on Dogfish Head doing this and this and this and how this is great for craft beer. And then, you know, here we are 6 months later finding out, or whatever it was at the time, that, you know, they were getting bought.
Right, getting bought.
That was I don't know what Rodenbach thought about that.
Right. All right, Sal. Bold predictions for 2020, buddy.
I think there will be laws when drinking White Claws.
You think there will be laws?
When drinking White Claws.
All right, is this going to turn into a rap of some sort?
No, apparently there's no claw when you're drinking, no law when you're drinking White Claw.
Oh, okay.
So I think there will be laws when drinking White Claw.
Okay.
You
got anything else beyond that?
No, I was joking, of course, but I really do think...
I didn't know where to go with that.
I really do think you're not hip with the memes, never mind.
I'm so not hip with the memes.
I really do think that we...
I did see the Baby Yoda with the White Claw, though. Did you see that?
No, I did.
Oh, it's a thing now. Like, yeah, okay,
that's
but anyway,
phenomenal.
Don't mean to distract you. Go on.
I do think that they're called malt-ternatives, is what they're called. And I do think we will see a rise in malt-ternatives. We will see that. Things we talked about, I think we will see a rise in non-alcoholic beer. In lagers, I think we're going to see those trends continue to push into 2020.
Okay. Anything else you got more bold than just continuing trends?
I can't think of it off the top of my head, but okay. I'm really looking forward to seeing what new styles emerge. You see a lot of these guys throwing lactose to the point where a lot of them are ridiculously sweet, almost cloying. Quote-unquote IPAs,
okay.
Which, of course, is a contradiction in of itself, a sweet IPA.
So explain that, because is a bold prediction. This is what I want to hear.
Yeah, so, you know, the kind of the hallmark of the IPA, the India Pale Ale, are these medium-high to high bitter beers. That is the point of the style. And it's just so bizarre to see that people come in with these New England IPAs, and they call them New England IPAs, or it's whatever type of IPA, and they add lactose to them. That seems to be a bit of a trend right now. So I'm kind of curious to see how things like that pan out. Yeah, we talked about the emergent IPAs.
IPA, yeah.
I really kind of want to see what's going to happen.
Okay.
These contradiction of styles are weird. It's kind of like saying, here's a bitter barley wine. It's like, wait, what? The barley wine's a malt-forward sweet style. What did you just do? So I'm really kind of curious to see how people push these envelopes.
Okay, so pushing the envelopes and sort of breaking down these barriers of categories.
Correct.
And Matt, I'll ask you to give if you have any predictions, but doesn't a tap room in this kind of situation, this is the laboratory for that type of stuff to happen, right?
I mean, I've always kind of wanted just to brew a beer and throw a recipe together the day that I brewed. And just order yeast and just have it here and just throw something together and see what it comes out like. And just, you know, maybe it might be the bitter barley wine. I don't know. But, like, what hops do I have that I have opened right now that I just want to get rid of? Yeah. Let's just throw them in there and see what happens. No, I don't know. But it is. It is. And, you know, the cool thing about what we do here, since we don't have to depend on some of the requirements of a distributor telling us that we need to meet this like distribution goal, if I decide that I'm going to brew like our New England IPA, and then I decide, you know, the day that I'm going to brew it, that I have a couple extra bags of this malt and I just got this hop order in, I'm just going to create a new IPA that day, because I'm I'm not bound by a distribution thing where I have to meet somebody's requirements, so
and fit it in their SKU,
right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so I can just create a new one. And we've done that with some beers. We've just altered things and changed things. And when you taste it, you know, you decide, this is a new beer. Well, we have to come up with a new name now. So, it's kind of cool to be able to do that.
Cool. Mm-hmm. And anything else you got that you want to throw out there? Put yourself on the line.
On the line? I did read this article. Virgin Galactic was supposed to, they're coming up with this new way of space travel, where they're just going to go straight up into space and come straight down, and within like a half hour you could be in Europe. So what I'm hoping for in 2020 is that I can get to Munich in a half an hour, have a beer, and get back before my lunch is over.
That's a bold prediction. And actually bring fresh beers back
right.
that don't taste the same after
right.
they've spent, you know,
3 months coming across the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah, maybe that'll change the way beer distribution happens. I don't know.
That's a bold. That is
send it to space and bring it back down.
Bold prediction. Well, that creates a whole different aging consideration in zero gravity. Right. Yeah. Zero gravity beer. Okay, this is bold prediction. Yeah. 2026.
New trend.
New trend.
Yeah.
You heard it here first, friends, on the NOLA Drink Show. Matt, tell one more time before we get into the food that the chef brought us. Where do we find Old Rail Brewing Company?
We're on 639 Gerard Street, Old Mandeville, just to the east of the causeway.
Awesome. BJCP, buddy?
BJCP.org. Find them on Facebook. Find them on the internet. And that's it. Learn how to judge. Come out, judge competitions. Read the beer guidelines. The whole bit.
And we may find you behind the bar at Grateful Ape in Old Mandeville.
You may find me behind the bar at Grateful Ape.
That's a topic slinging
drinks.
Another time.
Slinging cocktails.
Guys, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian.
Friends, we're going to take a brief musical interlude. I'll be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. I do appreciate it. As always, quick programming note for you. Next week's show, really good one. We're going to pay another visit to our friends at the Historic New Orleans Collection. They have a new sports exhibit, and we're going to be chatting with oral historian and senior curator at HNOC, Mark Cave, the man largely responsible for this new sports exhibit. And interestingly enough, the exhibit is really fascinating. It's not just about sort of the games themselves. It goes back to, it really picks up after the Civil War in New Orleans, and talks about the importance of sport as it relates to issues of inclusion, as it relates to issues of economy, just various social viewpoints of sports and its importance to the city of New Orleans. But I think it's also very, and its history, but I think it's also very accurate to say that many of these stories, although the faces will change and the locations will change and some of the sports will change, I think a lot of these concepts are highly reflective or valid when we look at sports in other parts of the world. Now, certainly there's a lot of uniqueness to, for example, the post-Civil War world here and sports operating in the Reconstruction era in the South. But it's a fascinating, fascinating exhibit. Mark is a fascinating, interesting individual, and we look forward to chatting with him. So be sure to tune into the show next week, friends. Yep, here's our parting shot. And as you know, on this show, we talked sort of, about the year that was in beer. And interestingly enough, the Brewers Association, which is the trade group that represents craft beer in the United States for the most part, right on the heels of when we talked with Matt and Sal, they put out their sort of year in review as well. Now, let's caution this just a little bit, because as we talked about on the show, they largely did what we did in a sense, where they took a lot of the predicted 2018 trends and hashed them out maybe a little bit where there was some information to back up what happened or didn't happen. But we really don't have the hard numbers, and we're not going to see those probably until starting in the spring. And so when we start to see those numbers, of course, we'll revisit that, see what we said on this show, and do a compare and contrast kind of thing in some of these other industry reports that come out talking about, really what did pan out in 2019. It'll be interesting to take a look at that. It is very difficult, friends, to, in the beer industry and the craft beer industry specifically, as we're discussing here, to measure things in real time, frankly, because there are so many breweries out there, and just the way the data is recorded or not recorded until we start to see final hard numbers, it's really difficult to give you exact running totals, as it were. One thing that the Brewers Association report predicted was that we will see about 4% growth for craft beer in 2019, which is roughly the same as it was in 2018. Certainly, we have moved into a pattern of steady yet single-digit growth. And so that's, I think, pretty firm. And that sounds very, very viable to me, that 4% growth in 2019 is a pretty realistic number. One thing that we actually said on the show, too, we were talking about 8,000 breweries. I think I mentioned that operating in the U.S. Not quite exactly that. Let me clarify a little bit. They said that certainly they were confident, the Brewers Association report said, or certain, I think was the word they used, that 8,000 breweries at one point or another over the course of 2019 were in operation, but not 8,000 breweries operating simultaneously at one particular point in time in 2019. And that is due to the number of closings of breweries in the country. In fact, they predict that by the end of 2019, rapidly approaching, we will have seen 300 plus closings of breweries in the U.S. One interesting thing that's kind of a positive is that of the closed breweries that we've had recently, almost 23%, 391 in total, have a new brewery in that location. So people are, they call it the hermit crab phenomenon, people are reusing brewing spots, which is, that's good for all kinds of different reasons that are rather obvious. This is especially true in popular craft beer cities. So for example, Portland, 24%, San Diego, 37.5%, Seattle, 28.6%, and Denver, actually a whopping 36.4% have breweries operating in spaces that had closed. So good news there, I suppose, on one level. Independent craft brewing, the seal that they have come up with, which is a sort of an upside-down bottle thing. I think this is an important thing. This was started in June of 2017, I believe. More than 4,700 craft brewers are using the symbol now, and that represents about 80% of the craft beer produced in the United States. Why do I think it's important? One, because one of the things that we see lately in recent years is large breweries, you know, InBev, the Anheuser or Bush people of the world, acquiring small craft labels. And it's a bit misleading. I'm not necessarily, you know, I think it probably varies. Do production methodologies and the people's change? In some instances, I'm sure they do. In other instances, they probably leave them alone. But if you want to know where there's true craft beer, which I think is important because oftentimes, for the most part, the vast majority of instances here, these are local businesses providing money to the local tax base, local jobs, and so on and so forth, excuse me. So I think it's important. And yes, certainly, you know, people that are operating small labels under a larger umbrella, there is money going back into the local economy and things, don't get me wrong, but that's not the same as a locally owned and operated business. I think we know that. So, you know, I hope that the independent craft brew seal continues to grow. Again, it's an upside down looking bottle. Be sure to check that out and support those people. And I think it's interesting to talk about where will growth potentially come from in 2020 and beyond. We did touch on the idea of tap rooms, brew pubs, excuse me. Wow, having a hard time talking today. The direct at the brewery model, what we can call it, might have some more run in it. I think that that's probably the case, but I think that is probably going to tap out, no pun intended, at a certain time. There's just not that much room for growth. You can only have so many of these, right, in a given location. We have them around the New Orleans area to a degree, Old Rail being a very, very fine example, of course, of it. But, you know, there is going to be a finite limit there. And of course, when we're talking about these operations, they don't produce a huge amount of beer, right? So that's also going to be, you know, kind of a drop in the bucket, if you will, the beer bucket. Again, no pun intended, well, maybe. When we look at overall growth, it will contribute. And that's a place where we might see growth, but that's a very small percentage of the overall beer landscape. I think it'll be interesting to watch moving forward, people focusing here. Some people saying we need to focus on our core brands and returning to what it is that made us what we are and do, you know, focus on the six things we've done well and continue to do well. And then there is also balancing that, though, something we touched on about people, you know, that a lot of beer drinkers always want to try something new. So I think it's going to be very interesting to watch in 2020 and moving beyond how breweries and brewers, brewmasters, strike a balance between focusing on their core brands, which makes economic sense in this sort of flat growth that we have, but then also catering to the beer nerds, if you will, of coming up with something new. It'll be interesting to see if that challenge of chasing trends continues. The New England IPA thing, I think, is a really good example. We do see that when something becomes popular, everybody jumps on the bandwagon. And we've talked about this in previous shows that I think a lot of breweries, a lot of brewmasters themselves don't even want to be making New England IPAs, but they feel that they have to. Then all of a sudden, everybody makes one. Then we got a gazillion, and then maybe we get a little bit of contraction or people move away from a trend. So it'll be interesting to see, again, where that balance strikes as we move forward, if the balance actually does strike at all. We did talk about the malt beverage category. Think White Claw and Truly and those in 2018. That was up 5.1% from last year. I can almost bet the farm. I will bet the farm on the fact that in 2019, that number is going to go way, way up. Lots and lots of breweries are starting to make a malt beverage, you know, flavored thing like White Claw. And that'll be interesting to see, too, what that does, because we're going to have a very, very crowded pool coming up here very soon from both big houses as well as small houses looking to jump on that trend. Now, I do think it's a good thing. A lot of people aren't super into beer, and it does provide an alternative when you go somewhere, say, to go to a tap room or something, if they start making it, or go to a brewery to the tasting room, it gives you something else to drink. And also, if you want to support a local brand, if they start to make it, that's a great option. But how many of those do you really need? The diversity, at least at this point, is pretty much just, you know, malt beverage flavored with fruit or fruit juice. There's not a whole, in my view, not a whole lot of room for variation in there. So it'll be interesting to see as everybody starts making it. As I said, there's going to be a lot of kids in that pool coming real, real quick.
I think we're going to continue to see acquisitions by larger houses of smaller houses. I think that trend will, of course, continue. It'll be interesting to see who snaps up what and who goes where. I think we're also going to see some mergers of some of the mid-sized guys out there as well to try and create a situation for them to stand up to some of the bigger houses and become more efficient in their production and things like that. We've already started to see that, of course, a little bit, but it'll be interesting to watch that. I think we will see more of that stuff. I do agree with the guys. One of the things we said, that hops are here to stay. Now, where that variation kind of goes, are we going to continue to see New England IPAs be all the rage? A lot of people are predicting that the West Coast IPA style is going to make a comeback. Lots of ways that hops can be expressed, but hop heads are hop heads, and I don't think we're going to see a whole lot of change overall with hoppy beers. Now, I do think that we're going to see a pullback from the extreme pushing of the envelope of hop beers that only appeals to certain people, and I think, you know, I can only speak personally in this regard, but I know I kind of got tired of it a few years ago. And so those ones that push the envelope just really hold no interest to me. But in the broader sense of beers that are hop forward, yep, they're not going anywhere in 2020. I'm wondering if we are going to see a ceiling for breweries coming soon. We're going to hit that 8,000 mark, presumably in 2020. It'll be interesting to see basically closures versus openings. And if we kind of hit a sort of stasis, if you will, of number of breweries in the country. I'm not going to predict that 2020 is going to be that year, but I think it is on the horizon. It's coming soon. We're going to find a balance, really, because people are drinking less and people are drinking broader across categories. That's just not going to continue to sustain the number of breweries or growth, rapid growth of the number of breweries. And I do think that that kind of relates to the last thing I'll say here, is that back when you go 10 years ago, 8-9 years ago, when the industry, actually less than that, 5-6 years ago, when the industry was experiencing double-digit growth, rapid growth meant more things, more beers, more beer styles, all kinds of stuff, people doing different stuff out there. Now that we have slower growth, I do think we're going to see more of the same. I was talking about striking that balance between focusing on core brands and chasing the new. The core brands, I think, will reemerge a little bit more. People will play it a little closer to the vest in what they've done, because slower growth means you just need to continue to do what you do well and sort of fortify what you have moving forward. I think that you're going to see less risk taken and that sort of thing as we move into 2020 and beyond as it relates to the world of craft beer. But hey, it's going to be cool. It's going to be interesting. I'm still going to be out there drinking craft beer, and I hope you will be too. Friends, that's our parting shot. Here's to you.